aftermath of the Vietnam War. The text of my sermon is that after the strife of war begins the strife of peace. Once during the Vietnam War, I was sipping a bottle of Bam Wee Ba beer on the Saigon Continental Hotel veranda with a visiting psychiatrist friend from New York, Park Avenue psychiatrist. And he was telling me about his patients and who they were and what their problems were. Not always by name, but at least a description of them, half of whom I recognized as being public figures. So I asked him at one point why it was that all his patients were rich, they were famous, and they were worldly successful, and there they were stretched out on his couch. And he replied that being frustrated by denial of the things that you dearly wish for is unpleasant and difficult to cope with. But the real difficulties in life begin when you get everything that you want. Well, it's been 23 years since April 30th, 1975 in Saigon when Captain Bui Quang Tan of the Pabin 203rd Tank Regiment rammed his Soviet-built T-54 tank through the wrought iron gates of Independence Palace and symbolically ended the Vietnam War. There is irony to that moment, as there are many other ironies in the years that followed. When the palace gate went down, most outsiders believed that whatever else, peace had long at last come to Vietnam. And yet a scant 4 years later, Tank 843, now with a new commander, spearheaded Pabin's invasion of Cambodia. As far as we know, Tank 843 is still there. My psychiatrist friend's observation about getting all that you want in life, what it can do to you, might well be the epitaph for post-war Hanoi, particularly for its Politburo. And it's equally applicable, I should say, as a diagnosis of virtually all of Indochina's Hanoi-led post-war behavioral difficulties. Vietnamese communist leadership system, highly unique leadership, which performed so well in the service of its golden cause, unification, and against such a formidable foe over such a long period of time, proved to be totally unequal to the peacetime challenges of binding up the wounds of war, launching a nation-building and economic development program, and establishing reasonably good relations with its neighbors and with the world. Post-war life for Vietnamese people proved to be one of wasted sacrifice and dashed expectations. The country did not become a land of 10,000 times more beautiful, as Ho Chi Minh had promised throughout the long years of war. Rather, it descended into a grim time of troubles marked by new wars, economic decline, and enormous individual suffering. A bitter debate broke out among the Hanoi intellectuals and in the Politburo over the reasons for this post-war failure and what to do about it. I remember one of these Politburo members telling me some years later that he was still puzzled by what happened, why it was that there we were on the gates of victory, we'd won it all, and then everything went to hell. And he said, it was so hard to govern after the war. During the war, it was very easy to govern. But after the war, nothing seemed to work right. And of course, he did not blame himself or his fellow Politburo members. The neck of the bottle is at the top, as the Vietnamese say, but not in Hanoi. Anyway, it was not really until the early 1990s, maybe you can begin this 1989 or up to 1992, that Vietnam was able to emerge from this long nightmare of psychological decline. And it was really triggered, I think, by a utter disaster in crop production in 1989, when there was simply not enough food in Vietnam. The 1,500 calorie per day, which the UN says is basic sustenance, was below that level. There was starvation in rural parts of Vietnam. There were rice riots in rural Vietnam because people don't starve quietly these days. The way to look at Vietnam today, I should say, if you're seeking understanding, is to consider it to be a place of great change and of great continuity. As we have seen during this course, Vietnam and Indochina, of which it was part, were the scene of a half century of struggle over the question of who is to rule and what kind of a political system is to be employed. Japan's imperial ambitions were ended with its defeat in World War II. France's colonial empire died at Dien Bien Phu. Whether there would be two Vietnams, one socialist and one capitalist, or a single Vietnam, was settled by Hanoi's decisive military victory in 1975. Vietnam would become one socialist country. However, since the one immutable law of history is the law of change, that too soon came under challenge. Throughout this constant change in recent Vietnamese history, there has run like a musical counterpart a countervailing force of continuity. It has many parts. Still present very much is the lingering force of traditionalism. 70% of the Vietnamese live in villages, and their lives in many ways differ a little from pre-colonial days. There is the spirit of Doc Lop, roughly translated as independence, meaning a profound resentment against foreign control, but also a strong desire for sustenance, for psychic support from outsiders. A yin-yang relationship. This has existed for more than a millennium, and it's chiefly directed, I should say, or focused against the Chinese. Geographic regionalism, this famed north-center-south division, at least 800 years old, maintains enduring separate self-images, prejudices, and stereotypes among the peoples of the three regions. It is as important in social terms as, say, caste is in India. There is a deeply instilled spirit of Vietnamese Praetorianism. It's not jingoism, it's not Junker-type martial mentality, but it's a Praetorian spirit, much a little like, I guess, the early Romans. It's a sense, in any case, that history has doomed the Vietnamese, who live in a bad neighborhood, to also be living forever in an armed camp. Now, those continuities remain strong today, and many of them act as barriers against the forces of change. A comment on the aftermath of the war in general. Logically or inferentially, I would say the Vietnam War can be said to have been the causal force of a whole host of events worldwide, among them some of the major political, diplomatic, economic developments of our times. This, of course, is, quote, after the fact, because of the fact, as B follows A, therefore A caused B. Faulty logic by Greek standards. Therefore, these historical interpretations can really be only speculative as to the causal effect, but they are interesting. It can be said, and has been said in various camps, that the Vietnam War was responsible for these seven events. One, it brought down Nikita Khrushchev and ushered in a prolonged crisis in Soviet leadership. This is based on the argument that Khrushchev's weak response to the Gulf of Tonkin incident made him appear indecisive in his own leadership group, and that began his erosion of power. Actually, Khrushchev was voted out as an avoidance of the doctrine of individual leadership error. He was voted out on an issue, that is, corn production in Siberia. Central Committee was asked, or the party, was, the Central Committee was asked to vote to approve his policy of corn production. But it was clear that a vote for this meant a vote for Khrushchev. The vote against was the vote against him. And so when they voted against him, he was out. But this process began, according to this thesis, with his weak response to the Gulf of Tonkin incident. Two, Vietnam War brought down the President of the United States, Lyndon Johnson, ushered in a long period of social trauma in the United States, in many ways basically changed the U.S. political scene. Three, it brought on the Cultural Revolution in China. This was seen as a power struggle between Mao and the pro-Soviet figures in the Chinese leadership who were seeking rapprochement with the USSR. And Mao saw that he was being pressed by events in Vietnam, and he must get rid of his rivals before he got so boxed in on this issue of joining the USSR in action against, in the support of Vietnam against the U.S., that he struck and organized the Red Guard, his cultural proletarian revolution, permanent revolution notion, in effect bypassed the party and created a new political movement in the Red Guard, which then took on the party. All of which was, according to this thesis, began triggered by events in Vietnam. Four, it triggered a communist coup d'etat bid for power in Indonesia, which resulted in the destruction of the Communist Party there because it failed. They came very close. They had this plan to take all the generals in Indonesia and put them down this one well outside of Jakarta, but the generals got wind of it, and so most of these communist leaders went down the well instead. Five, it very nearly precipitated the Sino-Soviet War. This was a prolonged danger, you can say, throughout the whole Vietnam War. It was widely believed that this was almost inevitable. The eminent New York Times foreign correspondent Harrison Salisbury even had the temerity of writing a book titled The Coming War of Russia and China. But it was a well-accepted thesis that these two were on a collision course, and that in any event, the Vietnam precipitated the Sino-Soviet split, which started out as to who was to be number one in the world communist movement. That really is number six in effects of the Vietnam War, precipitated this complete split between the Sino-Russia and Soviet Union and China. Seven, it ended the Cold War, or it began the process of ending the Cold War. I'll come back to this later. Now, none of this is really to be taken too much at face value. These are sort of sidebars that about history that I think make it interesting, speculative. A little late to say this, but you could write a term paper on any one of these. The outcome of the war, communist victory, had an enormous lingering social, political, psychological effects on the U.S., shaping both the subsequent foreign policy and domestic policies in 100 different hidden ways. This was particularly strong in the first few years after the war. It's largely dissipated now, I think. There's a new set of forces at work, but it was clearly there and lasted for quite a while. And during the time that it lasted, what it did was to create a new balance of power in Asia, and a whole series of changes that followed from that. China's hostility for Vietnam hardened. It was once been a lip and teeth relationship, and it wound up with a military invasion by China. There was a steady increase of Soviet USSR presence in the region. A protracted Vietnam-Cambodia war broke out. There was a massive exodus of Vietnamese refugees from Indochina. And there began a marked growth of regionalism, the ASEAN states, particularly among the Southeast Asian nations. All of these post-1975 events that I've just noted were probably inevitable given the outcome of the war. All right, pressing on to what the war meant, end of the war and what it meant, the death toll. It has been variously estimated, but the consensus seems to be it's about 2 million casualties. We will never know, because that's the kind of a war it was. What is clear is the ratio of civilian to military deaths was probably the highest of any war ever. It was probably 1 to 3, 1 military to 3 civilian. 455,000 in the south, 50,000 civilians in the south, 50,000 in the north. Total Pavan PLAF casualties are estimated at 1.1 million, Arvin at 241,000. U.S. battle deaths totaled 46,299, plus an additional 10,326 non-battle deaths. That is, military who died in Vietnam but not in combat. Automobile accidents, the three that fell off the roof of the Caravel Hotel because they were drunk. Now, this is out of a total of 9.3 million Americans who served in Vietnam. A third of these were in country, as they say. Allied country casualties was 11, that's the Australians, New Zealanders, Thais, Koreans, and so on, 11,300. It also includes, I think, this estimate, the number of foreigners who died in North Korea, or North Vietnam, mostly Chinese. Chinese manned the rail line that ran through northern Vietnam because it connected one part of China to another part of China, so they wanted to keep it open. So they had anti-aircraft units and other forces there, and according to the Chinese later, they took a heavy casualty. They never spelled these out, but 11,300 probably is pretty well. However, overwhelmingly, the burden of the war fell on the Indochinese and not on outsiders. It's a very telling statistic, which I don't think most Americans are aware of. The Indochinese casualties totaled 99.8%. And the foreigner casualties, everybody, totaled 0.2%. You get the impression that only much of what's written was only Americans who died in Vietnam. The fact is that 0.2%. Yeah, that's from, I'm not sure, 45, but, I mean, only a handful of Americans died during the Vietnam War. I don't want to, and I've not used many statistics in this course, because I'm very distrusting of them. The fact is that these figures simply don't exist. And, I mean, the American military death, those I think are accurate. You can get a complete list of the names and hometowns and so on. But the rest of these, I advise anybody who writes anything about the war, keep away from hard statistics. They can come back to haunt you. I've been haunted by one statistic I used in a footnote in one of about 2,000 papers I wrote that got quoted again and again and again and again. And it taught me a very hard lesson. Don't use hard statistics. If you've got them, fine. But the point is you don't have them. Well, during the war, with its many and various casualties, there was a general sense that the end of the war, when it came, and whatever it was exactly, would bring a halt to death and killing and suffering. This was the theme of the anti-war movement's most famous song, "All We Are Saying Is Give Peace a Chance." All we are saying, give peace a chance. Sing it for the Senate. All we are saying. Well, even those who supported the war probably believed that whatever else, the violent deaths would stop. But the end of the Vietnam War did not mean this. Chiefly, what it meant was that the four horsemen of the apocalypse, war, famine, pestilence, and death, continued to ride on unchecked across the face of Indochina, leaving in their wake a new enormous toll of human suffering. The anti-war demonstrators saying, all we're saying is give peace a chance. Well, we gave peace a chance, and the result that new increased suffering and death. People died by the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, died in the mountain passes leading from China into the border, China border, to the plains of Hanoi. They died in the steamy Cambodian jungles and mangrove swamps. More were claimed by the sea, or the sharks, or the Thai pirates, as they attempted to flee their homeland as boat people, or were expelled from it for being Chinese. Thousands died in starvation and of the many diseases which stalk the malnourished and the debilitated. Cambodia, under Pol Pot, was the worst of the worst. On a per capita basis, probably, it was worse than the Jewish Holocaust. The mass exodus from Vietnam, the boat people phenomenon, was one of the great human migrations of the 20th century. The United Nations Refugee Organization in Geneva estimated that in the first 5 years of after the war, the casualty rate of people leaving Vietnam by boat was 50%, mostly because these boats were unseaworthy or because of the pirates, mostly Thais, who descended on them. There was a bloodbath by any definition in Vietnam. This has not been fully documented yet, but there's a book by Carl Jackson and Jacqueline Desborough, which is forthcoming, which presumably is based on some very serious and complicated demographic studies as to how many people actually died in Vietnam in the so-called Vietnam Gulag, the re-education camps and the new economic zones. All in all, it was a ghastly period for the people of Indochina, one of almost unbelievable misery. As I say, we don't have any way really of totaling casualty lists, but it now seems certain, and this is a tentative conclusion by Jackson and Desborough, that more people died violently in and around Indochina in the years since the war than died during the as wartime casualties by a factor of two, most certainly, and probably a factor of three. All we're saying is give peace a chance. All right. That's by way of general overview of the aftermath of the Vietnam War. Now a bit on specific detail. Very briefly, what happened was that a kind of shroud of failure settled on the survivors, the victors and the vanquished alike. Failure was measurable by any index you care to employ, economic, political, social, diplomatic, military, above all, psychological. Clearly, in my opinion, responsibility for this rests with a dozen men, and there were no women, who held unchallenged monopoly of power in Hanoi, who proved themselves totally incapable of dealing with post-war peacetime world. Hanoi's leadership was exactly the kind of leaders, the right kind to face first the French and then the Americans in their long, hard war. It was exactly the wrong kind to bind up the wounds of war, launch the nation on a massive economic development program, and establish good relations with neighbors in the world. There was Holocaust or bloodbath or psychological trauma or social pathology, depending whether you want to use pejorative or clinical terminology. It was human suffering, as I've noted, on an unprecedented scale. Cambodia particularly descended into a kind of surrealistic hell of anarchy, starvation and disease, mass migration, and then war, savaged by an extraordinary death rate. That condition of suffering continues today, though at a much lower level. Pol Pot's brutalization of Cambodia is trying to return the country to the 14th century in the name of social perfection is so incomprehensible as to belong in a science fiction novel nor some black humor satire. He said, all of the problems of Cambodia are due to modern day civilization, therefore we will eliminate modern civilization. We will turn this country back to what it was in the golden days of Angkor Wat, 14th century. So for this period, you had no civilization, as we think of it. I mean, ever since Herodotus, historians have said, civilizations begin with cities, and they cannot exist without cities. And Pol Pot eliminated the cities, drove everybody out into the countryside. The irony is that he did this in the name of social perfection. Problem was there was in Cambodia during the Pol Pot period a few people got in, some Swiss journalists and came out and said that there's no money. The old reels, there's stacks of it all over near the bank, the old bank, which they blew up. It's just paper blowing in the wind. But there are no libraries, there are no newspapers or magazines or radio stations or schools, nothing. It's like no medical service. It's like it was here in the 14th century. Cambodia was an ultimate example of what happens to men and leaders when they're caught up in an ideological dream. It blinds them to the fact that human beings are the reason for all social change and who become willing, even eager, to sacrifice all humanity for the sake of a political abstraction. In Vietnam, the Northern Party cadres descended on the South with a kind of looter's vengeance. Their orders were to break the machine, that is, to reorganize Southern society and install a new social and political institutions to emasculate the existing social relations that had been in existence for 1,000 years. They started by concentrating on the villages where lived, at the time, two-thirds of all Vietnamese. Idea is that you would destroy the villages, as always known, and relocate people into communes, district-sized or county-sized commune, where they'd go out each day and farm. It was a tremendously ambitious plan. It never got too much off the drafting boards because it was an absurd idea, but it was Marxism carried to, as in Cambodia, it was Marxism carried to its logical conclusion. Because Marxists today would say Cambodia or Vietnam was not Marxist. But everything they did in both places, they said, is the name in the name of Marxism and Leninism. The middle-class Southerners, ethnic Chinese, even independent-minded proletarians in the South, such as fishermen, were driven out, often literally, as boat people, sometimes with malice, but mostly because there was simply no place for them in the new order. The middle class were told, your children cannot go to school, maybe the first three grades, but none of them is going to get into a university ever. We're not going to have any welfare for you because you are an enemy of the people. So people left. I mean, you can't expect them to have done anything else. 1 million of them left. I don't think if we who are not Vietnamese can appreciate the profundity of this statistic. 1 million left.
What's the population?
20 million. Just as we who are not Vietnamese can but dimly understand what it is like, as one of the most famous Vietnamese emigres has expressed it, no longer to have a city to build or a country to love. Thus, these Viet Q, as we call them, do deserve our sympathy and our understanding when necessary, our tolerance and our patience. Actually, by any objective measurement, such things really are impossible to measure objectively, but by almost any standard, the Vietnamese have proved to be the most successful group of immigrants this country has ever received. They've gone further in less time than the waves of those who came before them. Germans, the Irish, the Jews, the East Europeans, the Italians, or the other Asians. The one exception to this in demographic terms probably are the Cubans. The whole middle class in Havana moved to Miami, and statistically they have been somewhat more successful in material terms than the Vietnamese, who were a bigger group and a more diverse group. There are sociologists and economists, one of them, a friend of mine who's doing a book on this, we're doing a book, who maintains that it is these immigrants, not just Vietnamese, but all the current immigrants, he says, these people are going to save this country if it's going to be saved. Probably the most horrendous post-war development in Vietnam was economic. There was, from the earliest days, a disastrous decline in Vietnam's economy, which never was what could be called a model of success. Poverty today is still widespread, inflation is rampant, shortages of everything. There was a terrible shortage of caskets for a while. The basic affliction through these very early years, particularly, was economic stagnation, sheer inability of the leadership to get the economic sector in gear. This lasted at least for 8 years. Some people say it began to end in 1990. Others fix it as 1992. But there's no question that since then there has been a great improvement in the economy, enormous. It looks very good, particularly on graphs, because it started so low, but by any standard it would have been most fortuitous for Vietnam, and indeed for all of Southeast Asia. As a Vietnamese friend in Hanoi said, if we had had some historical conjuncture, historical accident, such as the pneumonia epidemic, which would have affected a quick generational transfer of power in Hanoi. And I said, you mean you'd have gotten a better leadership? we could have taken 10 names out of the Hanoi phone book and let them run this country, and they've done better than these clowns have done. Well, now time is doing for the Vietnamese what the Vietnamese could not do for themselves: install a new power, and hopefully a better one. The two decades plus since the war have been filled with astounding events, but quick addressing the economic condition has not been one of them. Finally, let me check off what probably are the chief developments, the most important developments out of the welter of developments after the war, the ones that are the most important, have the most overriding historical importance. These are listed in that outline you have there. I've talked about the first one, the social pathology in Vietnam. Second major development was the breakup of the so-called Red Brotherhood and the start of an internecine war between these former comrades. This involved the Vietnamese communists, the Khmer, Khmer communists, Chinese communists, and the Lao communists to a lesser degree. It also involved the total emasculation of the NLF, National Liberation Front, and Viet Cong Southern Communist apparatus, who were simply emasculated as to prevent a threat, I guess, to the leadership of the North. Now, this breakup really was due among these various brands of communism was due primarily to the emergence of ancient rivalries and antipathies and the development of new national interests. The relationship we now know, or came to know later, was never as close as we believed at the time, but still it was an astounding development. It determined the course of events for the next two decades up to the present and will largely continue to set the pattern for the foreseeable future. Third development it's in the process of change, a new relationship between Vietnam and the Soviet Union, or now Russia. It became an alliance in all but name, a product of Vietnamese dependence and of Soviet opportunism. This has gone back and forth in the last 23 years. There's a big team of Soviet military, or Russian military, in Hanoi right now, talking about the future of Kamran Bay as a possible port for the Russian Navy. This is a provocative thing as far as China is concerned. But the change in the tighter relationship between the Soviets and the Vietnamese tended to polarize the region strategically. It pitted the three Indochinese states backed by the USSR against six ASEAN states associated with the US and Japan and China, in a sense. And that has emerged into a more complicated development, which is the fourth development, which was very marked at the beginning and has now evolved into what amounts to a new geopolitical arrangement in Southeast Asia, a changed regional balance of power. Hanoi, by virtue of its victory, was elevated to a new military prominence. Indochinese Peninsula is strategically located. Vietnam is now the second largest communist nation in the world, has the third largest armed force on earth, greater in size even than the American army. But their ability to project a force in the region is limited by an undersized air force and navy, a shortcoming they're trying to correct hopefully with Moscow help. Moscow isn't too, for reasons having to do with China, is not too interested in supporting. Well, this throwing away the fruits of victory by the Hanoi leadership, one other thing having to do with the region, is even more astounding when you compare what happened to the rest of Southeast Asia. At the end of the war, the ASEAN nations, Thailand particularly, were running scared, as they say, around the racetrack. They could no longer depend on the U.S. They were telling each other, we've got to depend on each other, that is the ASEAN states, which was probably a good thing. A little hard to take, but the result was you had a double helix. You had this downward spiral of events in Indochina and this inside upward spiral of events in the ASEAN states. It was a bitter irony, really, that... All right, what to conclude from all of this? The aftermath of the Vietnam War in Indochina, in brief, is an unrelieved record of failed leadership. Simply, the leaders that were in power were simply unequal to the needs and the demands of the society entering a time of peace. They had a great opportunity to create this brave new world, but they simply couldn't do it. They didn't know how to do it. They didn't trust measures that would probably do it. These leaders were at the time, and they continued on, that was the unfortunate part, a very dogmatic, anachronistic, implacable mindset. They're bugs in amber. They're isolated even from the younger minds within the party. They lived in their own little world. They had very little contact, actually, with other people in their own party. They used this principle of a struggle against any kind of problem that developed. The Dukhlap principle. In warfare, that's exactly what you want. Sustained, prolonged application of force. But in peacetime, you have a different set of problems, particularly economic, and that Dukhlap approach of sustained, prolonged application of force just doesn't work. It makes the economic problem worse. And the real puzzlement is that it took them until 1990 almost to realize this. Since then, we have had changes in the leadership. We went through this period where they were blaming everybody in the Politburo on their troubles. Blamed it on the Chinese, blamed it on the French, blamed it on the revolutionaries in their own midst, on the Americans. I had to sit and listen to a Vietnamese academic explain to me why coal production was so poor in Vietnam. It was when the French operated these coal mines, and most of the engineers there were French. And so in 1954, when the French left, the French engineers, coal engineers, went with them. And that's why Vietnam's coal production is so poor today in 1997. And I said, what have you been doing about getting new? Well, don't you see the French were to blame for this? The French should have taken care of it. The French should have sent in their engineers, or should have trained our engineers, should have done something. The whole notion escaped him that this was their country, their coal mines, their young potential coal miners and coal mine engineers. It's that mentality that really sunk the Vietnam leadership after the war. Never once did they blame themselves.
Did they have violated trading partners?
Well, they didn't have anything to trade, really. What they were trading for a while was coal, and that was their biggest export, sold it to the Japanese. then in 79, when they had this mass exodus, they took all the Chinese, and mostly in North Vietnam, and either took them to the border and pushed them off into China, about 250,000, and they're still there in camps along the China border, or they took them down and pushed them out to sea in boats, including the people that were they're coal miners. It was strip mine coaling. It was lignite mostly. And so most of the strip mine operators were Chinese, and they were part of the bunch that was scarfed up and pushed over across the border into China. The Politburo saying, well, we'll hire our own Vietnamese coal miners. It can't be that hard to dig a strip mine. It's sort of a bulldozer, isn't it? So that's what they were doing, and they were scarfing up this, you strip off the topsoil, and then you dig up this coal, and you load it onto a truck, and you send it down and put it on a boat, and it goes to Japan, and the Japanese come aboard, and they look at it, and they say, it's full of rocks. We're not taking it. Send it back. So they ship it back to Vietnam, and it's dumped there on the beach. And the Japanese say, don't send any more coal unless it's good coal. Well, in about a year or two, I'd say, they manage these new Vietnamese strip mine operators. You know, they're intelligent people, and they're easily trained and so on, and they learned how to do this, and they're now doing it pretty well. And that's where most of the coal is still going. That's about all they have to sell. They have some seafood, fish. But trade is it doesn't amount to much. I mean, it never has. It's mostly commodity.